Good evening. Welcome to the Filson Historical Society. If I could have your attention, please, we'll go ahead and begin our program tonight. I'm Mark Wetherington, director, and I want to thank you all for joining us, and especially want to thank the 26 scholars who are part of this conference and are going to help us learn an awful lot about guerrilla warfare and irregular guerrilla warfare in the Civil War era. And it's entitled, as you know, The Hard Hand of War, Irregulars and Civilians in the Civil War. There are several people I want to recognize. I want to, first of all, thank Glenn Carruthers, who is a professor of history at the University of Louisville. Glenn is in the back of the room. Raise your hand, Glenn. Glenn served and did an excellent job as the director of research here for 9 years and co-editor of Ohio Valley History. Glenn started this process of the hard hand of war as the topic. And I want to thank Glenn for all he did, because I remember when he talked to me about what the lineup looked like, it was just, this is outstanding. And it reflects the work Glenn did as a director of research. I also want to thank our two co-conveners, Professor Leanne Weitz from the University of Missouri, who is, well, you'll hear more from Professor Weitz here, and Professor Aaron Sheehan-Dean from Louisiana State University. Aaron, I know you're here. So there, right? Thank you. Thank you all three of you for this this very, very interesting institute that we're going to hear tonight and tomorrow and the next day. So we've got some time to spend together, and I hope you'll come back for as much of this as you possibly can, because this is so central to what we do as an institution, and that is to collect, preserve, and tell the significant stories of Kentucky and Ohio Valley region's history and culture. And the Civil War era is certainly one of those significant stories, and to see so many young scholars here at the beginning of their careers and understanding that you're at the beginning of your path and road and life, and that this is a place that values what you do and wants to support you and create a collegial environment for you as you move along your professional path. So with that said, I'm going to introduce Dr. Leanne Weitz, our keynote speaker. Her topic is Women and the Turn Toward Hard War, Putting the Female and Civilian and the Girl in Guerrilla. Professor Weitz is the Middlebush Professor of History in the Department of History at the University of Missouri. She teaches courses in the Civil War and Reconstruction, the history of 19th century women and gender relations. She is the author of a number of works on women, gender, the Civil War, and the 19th century South. She is currently working on a book manuscript entitled Kate Clark Quantrill, Girl Guerrilla, An Exploration of the Role of Sexuality and Sex Radicals in the Civil War and Its Aftermath. Professor Weitz teaches a number of courses on the graduate level, included a course on Civil War and Reconstruction, graduate readings, and U.S. gender history, and a writing seminar. She is also a Black Studies affiliate and offers a cross-listed course on the undergraduate level entitled Divided Houses, Culture and Politics in the Civil War Era. Among her publications are Occupied Women, Gender, Military Occupation, and the Civil War, Gender Matters, Civil War, Reconstruction, and the Making of the New South, Women in Missouri History, In Search of Power and Influence, and The Civil War as a Crisis in Gender, Augusta, Georgia, 1860 to 1890. And the last thing I will say before I turn the podium over is to basically make this announcement that beginning July 1, 2015, Professor Weitz will become the next Director of Research of the Filson Institute. So please join me in welcoming Leanne Weitz.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to coming here on a more permanent basis. But it's nice to start out this way, talking about something that I love to talk about, which is putting the female in civilian and the girl in guerrilla. But I have to start this talk with a bit of a confession. I think that it was pretty much already determined that I was going to become a guerrilla historian of guerrilla war by the time I was 10. I say this because by that time, if not years earlier, I had a full-blown Robin Hood fixation. And the Robin Hood of my era was this man, Richard Green. Isn't he a heartthrob? I mean, seriously. So I was one with the idea that the little guy could, if he was smart and clever and decent like Robin Hood, stand up to and trump the big guy. After all, Prince John and the Sheriff of Nottingham had more castles and horses and arrows, but they weren't the shot that Robin Hood was, and they weren't nearly as clever and brave. I mean, after all, you have to be pretty clever and brave to have a good time in the forest. And I was also particularly taken with the way that Robin Hood and his merry men robbed from the rich and gave to the poor. The poor but hardworking Saxon peasants, especially the women and children. Robin and his men never abused women. It didn't matter to them whether they were Saxon women or Norman women, but the sheriff and his men paid no attention to the suffering that their taxes put on the poor widow and children in particular. So, but I had only one issue, and I will say that that was a pretty big one in my 10-year-old crush on Robin Hood and his guerrilla war against the fat, lazy, corrupt, you name it, Norman aristocrats, and that was, drumroll, Maid Marian. So here we have Olivia de Havilland, who played in the 1938 version of Robin Hood alongside the dashing Errol Flynn. Isn't he a heartthrob, too? I mean, really. And to be completely accurate, Maid Marian was not referred to as maid until later. Initially, she was Lady Marian, ward of a rich and powerful Norman aristocrat who was in league with Prince John to take over the country in the absence of the good King Richard off fighting the Crusades. But take a look at her, seriously. Not only is she a ward who spends all her time in the castle, she is already a maid, or perhaps more accurately, a nun. Yes, she is converted to the cause of Robin Hood, but come on, mostly because he scales her castle wall, and really her big job is to dote on the guy. Doting, doting. So, the problem for a 10-year-old girl was that I could not both be Robin Hood, or maybe one of his merry men, and stand up to power, and rob from the rich, and give to the poor, and be the love of his life. That was my problem. So, you might think that the most recent 2010 version of Hollywood production of Robin Hood, starring Russell Crowe and Cate Blanchett, would set all that to rest. It only took close to 50 years, but sometimes you have to be patient and wait. Maid Marian in this version, that would be Cate Blanchett, is actually the mistress of Locksley. She doesn't just get to get out on her horse and ride astride, she runs the place. And when the enemy forces invade, she defends her estate, even to the point of sword play against a soldier who is attacking one of the women of her village. Yes, all this was taking some liberties with the story of Robin Hood as I knew it, but it was really that final battle on the beach where Robin joins forces with the king's men, or perhaps it was the prince's men, to fight off the invading French. And he's taking something of a beating. I think it's because he doesn't know that he's riding in the wrong direction. He's taking something of a beating and was glad to see reinforcements arrive on the field in the form of a sole knight in armor accompanied by a somewhat ragtag group of young village men. That was the point at which I lost it, because who was this sole knight in armor? You guessed it, Cate Blanchett. Okay, I thought you have gone too far here. Let's not completely lose the story to do what? I would say to be a fit for the gender conventions of 2014, Because in 2014, women are apparently capable of fighting, killing, kicking, just like any man. It's all over popular culture. There's Nikita, there's Covert Affairs. Even the History Channel has their Viking Shield women. So, oh, and I will say, it's not like this wasn't also the case in 1938 when Olivia de Havilland played Lady Marian, because, of course, you probably know that the next year, in 1939, she went on to play Melanie in Gone with the Wind. But her Melanie, I think, is really very similar, to her maid Marian, you know, particularly the hat. So, you know, you can tell it's the 19th century because the hat is out more. But really, if you know anything about Melanie, which I'm sure you all do, she's a nun in 1938 and she's a nun in 1939. So maybe it's a 12th century Marian or a 19th century Melanie, but basically she's always a 1938 woman. So where is the truth? Where is the history? Do we just go back over these old classics and, you know, rewrite them to fit whatever our, you know, contemporary experience is? One could, in fact, make the same case about Robin Hood. So the 2010 version of Robin Hood has very little to say about standing up to power. After all, the closing scene is all about Robin Hood riding out against the invading French, and it is even less to say about the rich giving to the poor, taking from the rich, giving to the poor. There just isn't much of the guerrilla left in this guerrilla war in 2010. As with the case of the cross-dressed Kate Blanchett, the defanged Russell Crowe may also be a sort of reflection of our contemporary situation. We are, after all, the military arsenal of the world. We fight guerrillas all over the globe, but they are not us. Much of the time, we don't even engage with the ground, much less the forest. We've got those drones now. The tenets of Robin Hood, that is, stand up against overweening power, much less the assumption of the connection between standing up to power and being on the side of the people, taking from those rich and giving to those poor, arguably fits uncomfortably with our current military location in global struggles. If, however, we go back to the beginnings of our nation, to the American Revolution, when we were clearly the underdogs, we have long acknowledged and continue to celebrate the role of the guerrilla war in winning our independence from the British. From the Tea Party in Boston Harbor to the outbreak of the war itself and the battles of Lexington and Concord. And of course, there is the much celebrated guerrilla hero of my childhood, the Swamp Fox. Thank goodness Frances Marion. Thank goodness for Disney. Not as inspiring as Robin Hood, but he would do in a pinch. The American Civil War, however, has long been a much different story than the American Revolution. And I know you were wondering when I would get to the Civil War, so here I am. I'm at the Civil War now. The guerrillas, most of whom fought against the Union forces, were on the wrong side in this war. Unlike the American Revolution, where guerrilla war made a vital contribution to our formation as an independent nation, during the Civil War, the guerrillas fought largely on the losing side, in the greatest threat to our nation's continued existence as a country before or since. So everything is turned on its head for a Robin Hood fan here when you get to the Civil War. In the Civil War, Robin Hood is a low-down, robbing, murdering thief, and Maid Marian is, well, the victim squared. Without even the benefit of getting the hero in the end, she is just ruined. As an illustration of that, I will show you an illustration at the time that was published in Frank Leslie's magazine, and this is a depiction of Quantrill's raid on Lawrence. Now, in Missouri, we all know about Quantrill's raid on Lawrence, but that's when the Missouri guerrillas in August of 1863 rode across the border into Kansas. That's why, actually, the University of Kansas hates the University of Missouri to this day, because they rode across the Lawrence and they killed more than 100 men and boys. Now, the people who did this picture were not there at the time. So this is their imagining, not unlike our imagining of Robin Hood in 1938, but this is the current, they're imagining what happened. They've heard about this raid on Lawrence. And so this is the picture that they give the public to read, to see. see. Now, I think it's very significant. If you look at this picture, here is a woman begging. Here is a gorilla robbing from a woman. This people is rape. You know, it's the 19th century. Mm. But trust me, that means this woman is going to be ruined in 19th century language. And here is a guy who's about to shoot a woman in the back. You might think that the gorillas had no interest in men at all from looking at this. Because after all the people that they seem to be going after are in fact women. I mean, the reality was no women were hurt that anyone knows of in this attack. I mean, what they were really doing is shooting men. They were not shooting women. And they also came in before dawn. So I think it's very doubtful that all those women were out there running around before dawn, unless those gorillas actually hauled them out. And this is pretty much the way that guerrilla war is depicted to this day. So here is another period picture. And this picture is, it was done in August of 1862. It's about Morgan's raid, which you all may be more familiar with because that went through Kentucky. And also, much to my surprise, I went online to make sure that the title of my talk was correct. And I saw that this is, in fact, this is the foreground of it. But if you go and look online for this conference, this is, in fact, the illustration that is being used for this conference. So my point is that even to this day, whether we see it or not, you know, we're looking at something that is about guerrilla war, but we don't necessarily see what it is we're taking in. And once again, the central figure in this is this woman who's down begging, and they are attacking this old man. And I particularly like the way they grabbed her by the hair. So, what is the girl fan of Robin Hood to make of this? Well, one thing you learned if you studied your Robin Hood diligently as a child is never to believe the proclamations of the Sheriff of Nottingham, much less Prince John. Of course, they were always putting a price on Robin's head and trying to make the people believe that he was the problem and not them, and they had the power to make it appear to be true. You had to be brave and take your life in your hands to stand behind Robin. So many years later, it only made sense that this girl, Robin Hood, should take her life in her hands. Well, okay, maybe only sort of her academic life in her hands, because that cover of that book, that guy won a $50,000 prize for this book. It's like, this is like a big-time book here. So he's taken on, you know, the powers that be. And so here, however, is how historians, as opposed to popular culture, and this was popular culture at the time, here's how we do our work. We revisit the primary documents. We call this revision. So here is a foundational document in the history of the guerrilla war. Perhaps I should say it is sort of the Civil War equivalent of one of the sheriff's proclamations against Robin and his men. It was issued by this man, Henry Halleck, who was so unfortunate as to be the commanding general of the Department of the Missouri during the first year of the war. And I have to thank Andrew, wherever he is, Andrew Fialka, who designed this map for me. And it's apparently very difficult to figure out these departments. I think don't we expect that these military historians will know exactly what the departments look like, but they're all the time apparently changing, so it took a lot of work to come up with what the Department of Missouri, which is right here, and what the Department of the Ohio looked like at the time that Henry Halleck was in fact in charge of this department. And I was really hoping, part of the reason why I had this map there was I was really hoping that it would include Louisville. And so here's Kentucky, right? Mm-hmm. And it takes a little tiny piece of Kentucky. But where would it be? Louisville, right here?
Up a little.
Up a little. If I come here, I will learn where Louisville is.
The red line crosses. The red line is going north-south. Right there.
Oh, that's the way they beamed into the Department of Ohio. Yeah. Well, forgive me. So here's Henry Halleck. He's in charge of the Department of the Missouri. at the beginning of the war, unfortunately, I said, because guerrilla war raged pretty much out of control throughout much of his department from the war's outset. And he tried various ways of controlling this civilian unrest. And here in particular, of course, we're talking about Missouri. We're talking about the slaveholding border states, the states that remain within the Union. That's where you get this initial outbreak of. So he's kind of in the hot seat, Henry Halleck. And so he tried various ways to try to control civilian unrest, having his men administer loyalty oaths, confiscate property of Southern sympathizers, imprison them, but nothing really worked very well. So in January of 1862, he issued a kill-on-site order, refusing to recognize guerrillas as legitimate soldiers, and he ordered his men to kill them outright. Now, isn't that exactly what the sheriff did? Doesn't he kind of look like the sheriff? Basically, this order did not work out very well for General Halleck, in part because he could not always get his own men to enforce it. And I've actually seen instances where the cavalrymen who were supposed to shoot on sight were told that if they brought the guy back as a prisoner instead, they would shoot him. And even that didn't work. So what could he do? Well, he turned to his old friend, Professor Francis Lieber, Columbia University professor. I say, when in doubt, turn to a university professor. He turned to a university professor to come up with a better rationale for his take no prisoners order. And what he got by August of 1862 was this Union cavalry guide. So he's handing out this what I'm calling a cavalry guide. It's called guerrilla parties. What does that say? With reference to the laws and usages of war, written at the request of Major General Henry Halleck. So he's distributing this to the army, particularly to the cavalry. So you could think of this as being kind of a guerrilla hunting guide, because in the first place, how are you even supposed to know that somebody is a guerrilla? And so Professor Lieber explains to you, the Union cavalry guy, that there are two ways that you will know. You can tell from their uniform, and you can tell from the rest of the source of their supply. If they don't have formal military uniform or formal military supply, that makes them a guerrilla. So as far as the uniform goes, I think that the guerrillas clearly had a fairly standard uniform, right? And as we know, these are Civil War guerrillas, and as we know from Joe Beeline's recent article on guerrilla shirts published in Civil War History, the guerrillas also had a pretty standard shirt. Design. But they're basically a pretty standard uniform. So it's not about being a standard uniform. It's really about the fact that they're homespun. It's really about the fact that they're not coming from the military. They're coming from their households. And so here is where the question of the basic orientation of the guerrillas to the civilians enters the picture. Here is where Robin, who robs from the rich and gives to the poor, becomes Bloody Bill Anderson, one of the most notorious of Missouri's guerrillas. He's pretty scary. He's dead here, but he was always pretty scary. who pretty much, and he did have that name, Bloody Bill, who pretty much lives to rob and abuse innocent civilians because guerrillas, according to Lieber and his cavalry guide, did not have a moral, because they did not have a formal military source of supply, they were forced to rob civilians in order to get it. The guy goes on to compare the guerrilla to someone who invades your house. So it says to you, the Union cavalryman, when a robber, a thief, a highwayman invades your house and threatens your family, what do you do? What do you do when your castle is invaded? You shoot them. So come on, guys, shoot them. This cavalry guide was just the beginning of Francis Lieber's career as the architect of Union military guidelines for guerrilla war, and we will have a whole panel in this conference where people will talk about Lieber's code and the practical applications of Lieber's code. So I won't belabor that. I will just say that eventually Lieber's code would be signed into law by President Lincoln and issued as General Order 100 on April 24th of 1863, a date that many associate with the turn to hard war. But of course, it was hard war from the beginning in those border areas, like Kentucky and Missouri, occupied by the Union military from the war's outset. It was that hard war, that guerrilla war, which arguably created the necessity for first the cavalry guide and then the expanded Lieber's code in the first place. But back to Girl Robin Hood, guerrilla historian. What is to be done? How are we to read this cavalry guide? And I say, flip it. And here is where putting the female in civilian and the girl in guerrilla really comes into play. Because if the critical justification for shooting the guerrillas on site is predicated on the assumption that guerrilla war by definition, as a form of warfare, is grounded in the abuse of the civilian population, this justification only works if the civilian population is the victim and not the agent in the way the war is conducted. So if we were going to flip it, then we would need to argue the opposite, that precisely because guerrillas have no formal military line of supply, they are in fact dependent upon the goodwill, the domestic supply, the active support of the largely female civilian population. So what evidence is there for the support of women for the guerrilla war effort? And I say, thank goodness for the index to the records of individual disloyal citizens kept by the occupying Union military, Provost Marshal's office, that is now 90 microfilm reels, more than 70,000 individual entries of individual people who were called in by the occupying Union military for one reason or another and left this paper trail. Now, the problem with it has long been that it is just alphabetized. And also, I think the clerks that alphabetized it in the 19th century, maybe they should have stayed in school longer. Because they seem to have some strange ideas of how the alphabet works. But they're working with 70,000 things that they have to alphabetize. So basically, if you are interested in, for instance, talking about what women did, disloyal women, guerrilla women during the Civil War, and you have this huge record set, but you could die before you got through the A's, you know? So the Missouri State Archives volunteers for the Missouri State Archives actually went through the records pertaining to Missouri, and they created an index which is searchable and is online. So if any of you are interested in this, you can type in Missouri State Archives, Provost Marshal Records, and up will pop the index. And you can search it, and so this is what it would look like. So on the one hand, we would have the names of people. So you could search by name, you could search by county, you could search by, let's say you were interested in oaths of allegiance, you could search by, so there's a description, or people who had to pay bond, you could search by that. Unfortunately, it's not searchable by date. So for a historian, I'm not happy about that. But I certainly am happy that I, and you can figure out ways to find women, like sometimes they use misses, or so you figure out how you could use the index. So it's not the actual records that are online, but it's the way to search the records, and then once you know a name, you can look it up. So this is actually examples of this source that are all drawn from this county, Monitor County. And there's nothing particularly, you know, exciting about Monitor County. It's right here in the center of the state. It is next to the Capitol. It's not a heavy slave-holding state, although the heavy slave-holding states are along the Missouri River here and up and down the Mississippi. But the reason why I got interested in this county in particular was what I noticed when I was looking at the index was that between April 22nd and April 27th of 1863, there were 63 women who were called in to take loyalty oaths. So you can imagine what kind of, I don't know if it was terror, I don't know how all these women felt and the rest of the community felt when all of a sudden they were calling in all these women, in particular since they had never called in any women before, or at least none of them appear in the record. Because in order to appear in the record, they have to do what these women did. They have to take an oath of allegiance. So, you know, if the provost marshal was just unhappy with you and called you in and read you out, there would be no paper trail. But all these women were called in. They all took the loyalty oath. And before then, there were actually, to be completely accurate, there were two women who were called in before them, but it all had, those had to do with complaints of property loss to Union soldiers. So there are no women being called in for being disloyal. Now you might say, well, these women aren't disloyal because look, they're all taking a loyalty oath. They're all loyal. But you have to understand that the loyalty oath was one of the most important ways to control disloyal citizens, to control people who were assisting the guerrillas. You call people in, you make them take the loyalty oath, and then if they go on making shirts for their brother or whoever in the bush, then they're in big trouble. And you can see here, if you've really already been caught for doing things, and this is in fact a man, but he is being asked to also take the oath of allegiance and give a bond, $5,000, for giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States. So you could actually also be asked to give a bond that might be, for instance, the amount that your farm was worth, and then if you were caught again, you would in fact sacrifice your farm. So this is pretty serious business. And what I also thought was of note about this was that what you see here is we have these women. So here we have Martha, and here we have Nancy. And Nancy, they tell us, is 60. So Martha is probably her daughter. So they're basically taking in all the women of the family. But frequently, they have already called in the men. So the Union military came in 1862 in this area and established order. They brought these people in. They got them to take people, men. They asked these men to take loyalty oaths. So what's happening a year later, I would suggest, is that hasn't been enough. It hasn't been enough to stop them. So they're really going deeper into the households, and now they're going after the women in these households, and they know who these people are. I mean, they have identified them. You know, if you want to call in 60 people in a week, you've already targeted who these potentially disloyal people are, and it would also indicate that you know that they're playing an active role in the war. So I am basing this on these records and other things that I know, but I don't actually have the provost marshal talking. I want the provost marshal to say that they're doing this thing. I don't want to just speculate based on these records. So I go to the National Archives last summer, where they're huge. I mean, these records of disloyal citizens are just sort of the tip of the iceberg of the kind of records that the provost marshal kept when they were occupying these different areas. So I'm hopeful that I will go to Monitor County and I will find them actually saying what I think that they're doing. Unfortunately, the records of Monitor County have gotten lost. And this is the problem that historians have. Things just disappear. Then what do? You cry a little. Actually, I have known you cry a lot. You go out in the lobby and cry. Actually, I have noticed that a number of really important things have somehow having to do with women in the Civil War have gotten lost at the National Archives. Like, for instance, all the records of the female military prisons. They can't find them. They've gotten lost. And if you know your Civil War history, you know about General Butler and his notorious career at New Orleans. I had a great idea. I was going to go and read up on that. No one can find them. So I've gotten to the point where, you know, the magic eraser has once again removed the evidence. And I've learned to become a little more creative about it. So as I say here, so what does a gorilla do when it rains in the forest? Find a cave. In this case, you move over to the next military district. So here's Monica. We were up here, but the central military district is over here, and the main, what's called garrison town, is in Phelps County, but they are working on all of these counties, so they have sort of sub-provost marshal offices. And the central garrison town here is called Rolla. So I'm looking in these records, and what I found was both encouraging and frustrating. I was encouraged that in, once again, April of 1863, the Union headquarters in Rolla sent out an order to all those officers in those sub-counties calling for them to bring in all the women whose husbands were absent. You thought, well, now that's an interesting term. Absent. What does that mean? But it's later on clarified in the records. They mean either men who are known to be guerrillas, they're in the bush, or men who are in the Confederate Army. So those are the absent. They want all of those women to come in, just like in Manitow, come into Rolla en masse, take the loyalty oath, and then they were apparently expected to remain in Rolla, presumably so that the Union military could keep an eye on them and stop any support they might be giving the enemy, that is their male kin. I was particularly impressed to read the report from a Union officer in one of these counties who told of going out and notifying the women under his command only to have them decline to come in and say that they preferred to either cross the line into the Confederacy or go into the bush themselves. And in fact, when I looked at these counties that were under this order, I could find no women taking loyalty oaths at all. So on the one hand, I thought, well, cool, they're all going into the bush. On the other hand, I thought, well, they've all disappeared again. You know, it's like, I can't think that because I don't see women taking loyalty oaths that nothing is going on, right? Because I know the iceberg has just sunk. So what do I make of it? I say, if you don't have women in your guerrilla history, you don't have guerrilla history. What you have is Union military history, the sound of one hand clapping. If you do have women in your guerrilla war, you have guerrilla war as a much more serious factor in the way the Civil War was fought, if only because male guerrillas cannot simply be dismissed out of hand as a bunch of crazed men riding around, settling old scores, and abusing poor, innocent women. And what does this mean for women? If we begin to seriously put the female in civilian and the girl in guerrilla, I say the Civil War, any war, changes people. It changes men. It changes women. They change based on what they are called upon to be or to do. Gender relations are not rigid. They move, nor are we today the height of all gender progress. It is, in fact, a matter for further research. But to return to Hollywood, as an ahistorical conclusion as that might appear to be, I think I know what Cate Blanchett would say. But she is no historian, and the archives await. Thank you very much. Questions?
I had a question. Noticed that on the Oath of Allegiance on that list, there was one entry that said, what is the difference between, well, there's actually a couple of words that I signed. What's the difference between Oath of Allegiance and a loyalty oath?
As far as I know, there is no difference. Does anyone, there are many experts here. Does anyone know, is there a difference between something called the oath of allegiance and a loyalty oath? They're saying, no, they don't think so. And you know, in the 19th century, people taking these oaths very seriously. And you know, there are people when they come in to occupy these areas, they ask men to take the loyalty oath. And in particular, they ask men in any positions of power. So in order to keep your city position or to be an attorney, to be a doctor, you have to take this oath. And there are men at that point who decide to go into the Confederate Army and leave rather than take this oath. Yes.
You know, related to that, there was the name Mary Gregory.
Greer?
Mary Gregory in the list there. And she took it twice. It didn't take the first time?
Yeah. two years later.
Was it Mary Gregory?
Yeah, Mary Gregory.
Is it her or the woods?
Volunteers did a really good job, but sometimes they make mistakes. And so if I were guessing, I would say that it could be possible that there were two Marys, like it could have been the mother and the daughter, but I would say that date, particularly since it's May 23 and that's May 23, it's exactly the year is off. Sometimes it's these documents are all handwritten. And so sometimes it's hard to read them also. And so you're doing your best, and it's a three, but it looks like a five. But this is a good point.
Yeah.
It would be...
Yeah, it's 1910.
Good eye. You would make a good volunteer for a Kentucky index. Because until you get a Kentucky index in this state, you really are missing out on a really important source for civilians in guerrilla war. And it's, I guess, unfortunate you could say that Missouri only did Missouri. But they have shown the way to doing it, basically. Yeah.
Are there records showing women actually traveling with guerrilla band?
This I have not seen. Well, Kate Quantrill claims to have traveled with guerrilla bands and cross-dressed as a guerrilla when she rode with them, but I personally have not. That's why I found it very interesting that they were saying to these Union officers, "No, thank you. I will either cross Confederate lines or I will go into the bush." And really, frankly, that is the first time I have seen that. But to me, of course, that says, well, let's do some more research and see what we can find about that. I don't know whether other historians of... Yes?
I have a couple of things, Leanne. And I think I want to go back to the question about the oath of loyalty versus the oath of allegiance.
Yes.
And I could be wrong, too, as I was looking at these dates, it may not square, but I just got done doing some research in East Tennessee and looking at printed forms of the oath of allegiance.
Uh-huh.
And the oath of allegiance required the person to swear their allegiance to the Constitution and all laws and proclamations regarding slavery, whereas I think the loyalty oath did not.
Fascinating. Well, it's a matter for further research. Interesting.
And then the other
interesting.
Thing.
So why are they? Well, is it because of the date?
Well, I was looking at the dates you have there, because you have a couple of people in February of 1862 who have oaths of allegiance, and that's
right
before the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, so that doesn't seem to square.
Yeah. And it isn't like the women are doing allegiance and the men are doing loyalty, because here's a man doing allegiance.
Well, some people could spell allegiance and some couldn't.
Well, we could go and look and see, actually.
And then for Joe Stinson down there, what is jayhawking?
It's jayhawking.
Yes. Charged with jayhawking. Jayhawking is stealing.
It's stealing.
Yeah. Yes. I can tell we're in Kentucky and we're not in Missouri. Because the University of Kansas, their mascot is the Jayhawks, because they went across the border and liberated slaves from Missouri and anything else they could get their hands on. And they came to claim that term Jayhawk, though, because originally Jayhawk was a general term. It's from nature, refers to the jay, the bird, a jayhawk, which is a big bird, apparently bigger than other birds, and steals things from little birds.
Yeah.
And so, you know, highwaymen, it would be another, people who rob people on the road. And so it was a general term, and you can see that it was a general term even here in 1862. But eventually, at least in Missouri, Kansas land, the Kansas have claimed being the Jayhawks. And people have forgotten that it was just a general word that you use to refer to people who stole things from other people. But I will point out that in the cover picture, the 1862 cover picture for this conference, they actually referred to John Morgan, who was, in fact, a Confederate cavalry officer, as a highwayman. Uh-huh. So, I mean, this says something about the politics of the representation of that picture. So, when they call him a Jayhawk, he could have been involved in taking things from Union officers, for instance, which wouldn't be a matter of war, it would be a matter of being a robber. That's my point.
Interestingly, they probably didn't write down when the Union soldiers stole stuff from the civilians.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. Yes. Although there were the two women who filed a complaint with the provost marshal that, you know, their hay had been taken and they had not been given the pay, the money that was promised them. So they did go to the provost marshal to try to get justice. So it wasn't like they thought it was entirely, and yes.
If they were, in those cases, were in lieu of an oath of loyalty or allegiance, as the case may be, they put up a bond, or had, I guess, a bond that was a more severe suspicion.
Yes.
What, is there a record of how that was forfeited, or?
I don't know if there are records of which people actually, having put up a bond, lost their farm. The records at the National Archives are vast. You know, this is the wonderful thing about the military, unless they're losing the female military prison records, but I'm sure that they kept them to start out with. So it's like finding a needle in a haystack, but if you know what you're looking for, then you could find it. Well, they wouldn't be in New York. They would be in areas. Look, I feel uncomfortable answering this question in front of a whole group of people who are experts on guerrilla war and are going to be talking about it. No, it's a great question. No, it's a great question, and I'm sure that you.
I don't recall what's his name.
So look. Here would be my I think that the origins of guerrillas are specifically hard to place, but in general, you know, the Civil War is about the Union military going south and taking territory and occupying that territory, and what Daniel Sutherland, in a recent work on guerrilla war, has argued was we have been wrong to think that just because, you know, you won the Battle of Shiloh, that was the end of it. Mm-hmm. And I like to compare this to many of you are old. My students aren't old enough to remember this, but many of you are old enough to remember this. the Iraq War, you know, when George Bush is...
Oh,
is
the
and,
first one.
Yeah, well, no, the Iraq War when George Bush is on the aircraft carrier,
oh,
and he says,
right,
mission completed,
right,
because
right,
we've spent 6 months of formal military war. We've gotten to Baghdad, mission completed, and then it just morphs into guerrilla
right.
war. So basically, this is what historians are now arguing about the Civil War. You know, just because we took some place in a battle, it wasn't over then.
Mm-hmm.
It just morphed into guerrilla war. But along the border,
mm-hmm.
you know, those areas, like I'm most familiar with the history of Missouri, but Missouri is almost immediately occupied by the Union military.
Mm-hmm.
And after August of 1861, there are no more formal battles, but the state just morphs into this guerrilla war. Well, you know, when you don't have the resources to fight a formal battle, then you go to guerrilla war. And that war has been depicted in a way that is not very flattering to the people who did that,
right.
which is something of an understatement.
Let's
but
have a final question, Rob.
Oh, well, then could you spin out the last thought that you had about the ramifications for this rethinking of women's role in guerrilla war? So if we think of guerrilla war as much more important and then we want to rethink women's role, could you sort of...
Well, okay, so the argument is that basically, insofar as we think about guerrilla war, we've thought about it from the location of the Union military. And so we see, that's how we see it. But we don't really understand how guerrilla war itself works at all. So if you begin to think about how guerrilla war works, and the assumption of the Union military and the people who came up with the policy for dealing with them like Lieber, the assumption is that the way that the guerrillas work is that they basically rob everyone. So everything you hear is about how they rob people, they murder people. Sometimes you never even hear that they have anything to do with the Union military at all. It's like they're not even fighting them.
Mm.
They're spending all of their time robbing the guerrillas. And so what I'm suggesting is, while it may be true that they robbed the guerrillas, the Union military may have robbed the guerrillas, but if you're a guerrilla, precisely because you do not have the Union military supplying you, and all military historians know that the supply is critical, you are dependent upon people who will give it to you. You cannot be a guerrilla and run on robbing and murdering people. You have to have the support of the civilian population, and in particular, you have to have the support of the women. So if you can't stop the guerrilla war by just shooting the men, you know, the Union military figures this out, you have to go after the women. So if you're really going to understand the shape of guerrilla war, which we really don't understand, because all we really understand is how the military, Union military saw them. But we don't really understand, if we assume that it is a legitimate form of warfare, we don't really understand how it worked at all. We particularly don't understand what the women were doing. So that's what, is that good? Okay.
Professor Weiss, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll start our first panel in the morning at 9 o'clock. So I look forward to seeing you here. And thank you for joining us this evening.